Our next case this morning is A24-0352. I hope I pronounced this correctly. Zoots Farms versus Middle Snake Tarmac Rivers Watershed District et al. I guess my first question is, I see there are two respondents. We did not see any letters from you indicating you wanted to split your time, but if you do, would you tell me how much and who's going first?
Yeah. And Your Honor, I've had conversation with Ms. Bjornson, and it's my understanding that I will be presenting the oral argument for the respondents.
Okay. Is that right, Ms. Bjornson?
That is correct.
Thank you. All right, then. Then counsel for the appellant, as you are aware, you'll have 15 minutes for your argument in chief, and then the respondent will have 15 minutes for their argument. And then finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So counsel for the appellants, whenever you're ready, just please begin and tell us who you are.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Andy Keeper, and I am an attorney at Stoll Reeves, appearing here on behalf of appellants. The pronunciation is Zoots Farms, Your Honor, just so you're aware.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. The central question on this appeal is whether the court should reverse the Watershed District's approval of Christian Erickson's drainage permit as unreasonable and unsupported by substantial evidence. The answer is yes, and the court should reverse. The underlying facts, while characterized differently by each side, are not in dispute. Erickson applied for a permit to add 140 acres of drainage tile to his property, which it would outlet through a series of ditches, including appellant's private ditch. The Watershed District deferred consideration of the application for months on account of its defects, including Erickson's failure to secure consents from adjacent affected landowners, including appellants. Erickson withdrew the application to pursue a separate petition to add 48 acres to the benefited area of Judicial Ditch 25-1. The Watershed District then took up Erickson's application again, though it remains unclear, and the Watershed District has never explained whether or when the application was ever resubmitted or if it was submitted in compliance with Watershed District's rules. Appellants again refused to consent to the application, and the Watershed District unanimously denied the application for its failure to identify an adequate outlet for the proposed drainage. In doing so, the Watershed District informed Erickson he would reconsider his application in the future if he worked out a resolution with the adjacent affected landowners, namely appellants. Erickson immediately submitted a request for reconsideration in which he made specious personal attacks against appellants. Appellants continued to oppose the project, and the Watershed District allowed Erickson to supplement the record to pursue his reconsideration request and supplement the record with a one-page engineer's report referred to as the Dowager Report in brief, but only slowly responded to information requests from appellant's counsel. Appellant submitted a preliminary report from its own engineer, EOR, based on the late and incomplete data provided by the Watershed District. And the Watershed District set arbitrary deadlines applicable only to the appellants in their submissions on the reconsideration.
You know, on the arbitrary deadlines, isn't that the response that there was sort of 120 days to get this moving and, you know, that kind of drove the train? Am I wrong on that, Mr. Keeper?
I think that's an excuse that's been provided, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, it sounds like a pretty good one to me.
Well, and we can talk about deadlines here and there and what's applicable and what's not. They were operating within a 120-day timeline to hear the reconsideration request. But as we've discussed in our briefing and as I'll get to in my arguments, underlying rules here were selectively chosen what was going to be complied with and what wasn't going to be complied with. And the timing aspects that we're particularly concerned with here as applied to appellants and what prejudiced appellants was not necessarily the 120-day time period to hear the reconsideration request. It was the arbitrary deadlines that were placed upon appellants for their submissions of data, and then the arbitrary cutoffs of submissions of data in advance of the hearing within the 120-day time.
One question I had is on the remand, when the court wanted the sort of reasonable use factors to be gone through, one of your big complaints is, well, you know, the benefit to the farmer. And, you know, you complain that, well, all he said was it's going to increase his production. I mean, Why isn't that enough? I mean, that seems to, he wanted more water to grow more crops. I mean, are you saying he had to specify how many crops and, what percentage increase it was the water was going to cause? And I mean, what do you think was so defective about him just saying increased production?
Yeah, I appreciate that question, Aaron, because that hits on, so the three primary arguments that we've made are, lack of substantial evidence, the irregular procedure, and the arbitrary and capricious nature in which this proceeded. And so I think your question actually directly hits on one of the points that I wanted to raise with respect to the substantial evidence standard. And so as a reminder to the court, substantial evidence standard, which is laid out, for example, in Citizens Advocating Responsible Development, 713 Northwest 2nd, 817, Minnesota Supreme Court case from 2006, said that substantial evidence consists of relevant evidence as a reasonable mind would accept as adequate to support a conclusion, more than a scintilla of evidence, more than some evidence, more than any evidence, and evidence has to be considered in its entirety. So the problem with the quote evidence that was submitted on the reasonable necessity prong of the reasonable use doctrine, that's the first element of the reasonable use doctrine, is that the only evidence offered to in support of that reasonable necessity is just those three words, which aren't even full words. It's just quote, increase ag production. That's it. There is no evidence that's been submitted with that. It's a conclusory statement that was provided.
Well,
by
but I mean,
Erickson.
As we try to tell the clerk sometimes, we actually like to apply common sense here in appellate land. Generally speaking, if you get more water, you'll get more crops. Now, so again, are you saying, in order for it to be valid under substantial evidence in the record, he had to specify, okay, it's going to cause X percent more water, which is going to cause Y percent increase in corn or rye or whatever it is he's doing. And here's my calculations. Are you saying that's what the law requires as to that first factor?
Your Honor, I'm saying that under the substantial evidence factor, he needed to have provided something more than a conclusory statement that is just that it would increase ag production. And that is the substantial evidence standard. Otherwise, there's no point in having a substantial evidence standard.
One of the cases you cite on this point is the Gorky Family Partnership case. And in that case, we said that with respect to the permit application, the board found, and this was ultimately affirmed, that there's a reasonable necessity for such drainage. Evidence was presented. It doesn't specify what the evidence was, whether it was just the permit itself, or as in this case, or something else. And I did try to look at the briefs in that case. It wasn't immediately clear to me what the evidence was, but it showed that the land needed to be tiled, because it's in need of additional drainage to improve its crop output. And then it notes that no evidence was presented which disputed the need for additional drainage. And we ultimately concluded that evidence supports the board's findings. So I'm wondering, it doesn't look to me like there's any evidence in the record that disputes the permit statement that this will improve agricultural production. So why shouldn't we, if we agree with you that Gorky is an instructive case, why shouldn't we under Gorky conclude that reasonable use is met here on the first factor?
Yeah, because you're exactly right, Your Honor. I was going to point to that page, that line from page 56 of Gorky, which notes that there was evidence presented to support a finding of reasonable necessity here.
It's ambiguous though, right? Because it begins with a statement with respect to Croat's permit application, which might suggest that the evidence was the bald statement in the permit application itself, that there was a need for a reasonable necessity for drainage.
Fair, Your Honor, but that's also speculative in the sense that evidence means evidence, to me at least, in that there is some type of submission. More than just three partial words, increase ag production. That's not evidence. It's a conclusory, self-serving statement by the applicant himself. And there is zero evidence. There's not a single report, any type of statement that underlines that statement. That's the point. And so to your other question that joined that, Judge Eaney, is that because there was no evidence, there was nothing to respond to. There was no way, what were appellants supposed to dispute if the only argument is a conclusory statement, this will lead to increased ag production? I don't know what the basis for that statement even is, and I don't
well,
know.
I mean, you conceivably could have presented evidence that the permit isn't necessary to increase agricultural production on that piece of land. I mean, the statement was in the application. I don't know that you were precluded from supplying, as in Gorky, some, or as Gorky anticipated, some evidence that disputed the need.
Sure. But again, at the application level, the burden of proof is on the applicant. It's not on the adjacent landowners who may or may not oppose it or consent to it. The burden of proof is on the applicant. And the burden on the watershed district is to identify substantial evidence in support of its findings.
Well, if it's undisputed that it's going
to
improve
evidence to support that statement, that is in and of itself highly problematic.
Can I ask you one other question? I was just curious about your consent argument, and that, you know, the written consent of the owners affected by the proposed work must be obtained and be indicated in the application under the watershed district's rules. Mr. Sparby, in his brief, points out that the consent is limited to owners affected, and if the watershed district determines that your clients aren't affected, then their consent isn't necessary. What's your response to that?
There was no determination that appellants weren't affected. I mean, that's the whole point, is that appellants opposed it, and that is why it was denied in the first instance. So
I thought the ultimate determination is that any effect from granting the permit would be negligible on downstream owners like your clients. Am I wrong about that?
There was no finding of a negligible effect on the downstream landowners. What they're arguing is that, oh, because of how this project is structured, that would lead to a negligible effect. Our clients submitted letters to the watershed district in which they noted, and that's in the record, and we pointed to that in our briefing, in which they noted that this would not have a negligible effect, and that's why they were withholding their consent, and that's why they were opposing the project.
But so the other part of that, though, is that if what you're saying is true, then why even have this, you know, contested permit process to begin with? Because once your client withholds, as a downstream landowner, consent, then doesn't that end the matter completely? I mean, if you apply the rule in the way that you are suggesting, then the rest of the process is obsolete, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, again, this isn't my rule. This is the watershed district's rule. And we're going off of the language in the watershed district's rules, which says that the application must have written consents of the adjacent landowners.
But isn't a more logical interpretation of that if the adjacent landowners are unaffected, you don't need to get them to sign off? If they are affected, then they better agree before you grant the permit application.
But that's why it was continuously tabled, is because Mr. Erickson did not obtain the consents of appellants. Appellants opposed the project. They were encouraged to then reach out after it was denied to appellants, to the adjacent landowners, to work out a resolution. That's part of the reason why it was denied in the first instance. And the rule is what the rule says. I mean, you have to apply, as an appellate court, you have to apply the same rules of statutory construction to a local ordinance as to a state statute. And the rule says, in plain language, it requires that they obtain written consents from landowners. In this case,
affected landowners. We have to apply the affected.
People been denied. So, and that's the irregular procedure, you know, here, is that there was no discussion. There's nothing in the record at the watershed district level in which the watershed district said, hey, we're actually just not going to apply this rule the way it's written. Or in the watershed district's briefing, they're trying to argue to the court that, oh, this is actually only requires notice, not consent. But the word in the rule itself is must obtain written consent. And so that is part of the irregular procedure argument that we've offered here. The third point that I was going to touch on the arbitrary capricious factor, obviously we've offered a number of other explanations that and specific issues on all three of those parts. But this discussion of the alleged dike and why that was arbitrary capricious in that it represented the will of the agency rather than its judgment. We've obviously briefed that that argument extensively, and I see that I only have 30 seconds left at this point, so perhaps I will bring that up on reply as needed.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, Mr. Sparby, please. Sparby, you're not muted. You got to turn yourself on. Here you go.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Delray Sparby. I'm with the law firm of Eiley Sparby and Hazy PA in Thief River Falls, Minnesota. And our office represents respondent Christian Erickson in regard to this matter. And we will be arguing today also on behalf of the Middle Snake Tamarack Rivers Watershed District. And one of the things that I would like to point out is there's been a lot of discussion in regard to the appellants in regard to improper or irregular procedure in regard to the proceedings that were taking place. And I would argue that the only irregularities essentially were the fact that the Watershed District Board was bending over backwards for appellants counsel and for appellants clients in regard to the numerous continuances that were granted as part of this whole process. They had more than sufficient time to submit any evidence that they wanted the board to consider. And the record itself completely lacks evidence that was provided by the appellants. Even their engineering report states that it's not a formal opinion. And if the court takes a look at the EOR preliminary report, it points out a number of alleged deficiencies. But the one thing that it does not do is state that the opinions of engineer Tony Nordby and the opinion of engineer Nathan Dallagher were incorrect. And so there's nothing in the record that's been presented by the appellants to state that those two engineers' opinions, that there was sufficient capacity, that there's sufficient hydraulic capacity for the downstream ditch, and the fact that the drain tile itself and the contributing water is going to have a negligible effect. They also noted that the water is metered downstream. It's metered by three different culverts. So even if there is flooding conditions, the water itself can only get through at a certain rate because of the fact that it's metered. And then even in light of that, the Watershed District Board did agree with engineer Nathan Dallagher that there should be an operable gate put onto the drain tile system, which would be shut off if there was downstream flooding or other conditions necessitating that. So there's just tons of added protection in regard to it. There was also a discussion in regard to arbitrary deadlines that were set. And the intimation is that this was only applied to appellants and not to respondents. But I would note to the court that Exhibit 23 at number one and Exhibit 28, the Watershed District did inform Christian Erickson to submit any supporting documents and information to the district staff by the end of workday on December 1st, 2021. So the fact that there was an end of workday requirement for the January 28th end of workday submission deadline, I think that's just been consistent as far as Watershed District wanting to receive information to be able to provide it to the board so that the board would have time to digest and review it prior to a board meeting. So I don't know that there's been any irregularity or arbitrariety when it comes to the way that the proceedings were conducted.
Can I ask you a question, Mr. Sparby, about the reasonable use argument, in particular the discussion we had with Mr. Pieper during his argument? You both cite Gorky, and you rely on Gorky to analogize between the permit in this case, stating that it will improve, it'll increase ag production, and then the improving crop output statement in Gorky. But I think to Mr. Keeper's point, if you read Gorky at the end of the quotation from the board in that case, we stated that evidence supports the board's findings. I know that the permit itself was submitted as a trial exhibit, but it seems like that's the sole basis is the statement in the permit for why this would be, there is a reasonable necessity for such drainage. Can you tell me, is that the sole evidence that you're relying on, the permit itself, and why is that enough? And is that consistent with Gorky, which seems to indicate that there was some evidence to support the finding that there's a reasonable necessity there?
Yeah, I think if you take a look at the permit application itself that's prepared by the Watershed District, it has the question, work is necessary because, and then that was filled in by Mr. Erickson to state increase ag production. And attached to that is also the proposed drain tile system, where it would be placed, where the flow goes. And so I think that also demonstrates, you know, that there's going to be controlled drainage and the whole.
But why shouldn't we just consider that to be a scintilla of evidence, which wouldn't be enough under the substantial evidence standard, as Mr. Pieper is arguing?
Well, I don't know how you get to anything other than increase ag production, improve crop output. Do you have to measure it then? Is there a bushel limit? Is a scintilla of evidence showing that it increases by 5%? I mean, where is that arbitrary standard coming from? I think just the general statement of increasing ag production and wanting to invest in drain tile, which is a substantial expense, I think is somewhat self-evident in regard to the statement that's made. And we also have no evidence, you know, that's presented that states that, no, this drain tile isn't necessary. It shouldn't be installed. It doesn't meet permit requirements. We just have nothing in opposition.
But to his point, I mean, I know that the board said no evidence was presented, which disputed the need for additional drainage in Gorky, but I don't know that we adopted a burden shifting, analysis for reasonable use in Gorky that would apply under the framework set forth in Crawl. So I guess I just wonder, if we agree with you in this case, are we basically giving carte blanche to any future permit application? As long as they give some reason, it doesn't matter what the reason is, they don't need to justify it by any sort of evidence. I want to drain this land because I want to, you know, build a fort, or I want to drain this land for any reason whatsoever, then that's enough for reasonable necessity.
And I think if you had a situation like that, I don't know that that necessarily relates, you know, to the granting of the permit or to the discharge of water downstream. You know, here where you have increased ag production, I think that's a valid purpose, you know, for the farmer to be able to increase profit, to have additional yield, however you might want to frame it. You could characterize it as maybe too general of a statement, but I still think it's a valid statement.
Thank you.
And when they talk about the reasonable use, you know, there's certain factors. One is reasonable necessity. The other is taking reasonable care. And here we have the operable gate valve that can be shut down the drainage system if downstream conditions warrant it. So I think that's also addressed. The utility or benefit outweighs the harm to the downstream landowners, and two engineers found sufficient capacity in an adequate outlet. They stated that the discharge would have negligible effect, and even so, there's the gated operation. So the utility of increased ag production certainly outweighs any negligible effect or harm to the downstream landowners. And then the last factor is, where practical, it's accomplished by reasonably improving or aiding the normal and natural system of drainage. And by removing the dike that's contributing excess water, removing that from the system, I think the Watershed District, as part of the permit application, is aiding the normal and natural system of drainage and the 1.5 cubic feet per second that's being contributed by the grain tile is going to, again, have a negligible effect, especially in light of the fact of removing that dike and allowing that water to divert where it's supposed to go, as opposed to going down into the JD251 system.
Can we really say that, you know, on your consent argument that you make, that Mr. Pieper's clients are unaffected if part of the watershed district's analysis was that the dike, if they remediated the dike, then it would be a negligible effect? Because it seems like that, you know, they're putting some burden, and maybe rightfully so, on his clients if they put in an illegal dike. But as it stands, until they take action, can we really say they're unaffected for purposes of the rule requiring written consent from all affected landowners?
Sure. In regard, you know, to the written consent issue, I understand that that's in the rules, and it's been expressed by the watershed district that that's more of a notice thing, or trying to get the parties to work things out in regard to obtaining consent. But I also think you can take a look at it a couple of different ways. You know, one is that we argued the, you know, negligible effect, and I think that exists whether or not the dike is removed or not. Because there was the finding, you know, the adequate outlet, adequate capacity. There's not going to be adverse effect to the downstream landowners. So there's that. But separate from that, I think that the consent requirement in the rules is void itself. I don't think that you can deprive somebody from having a permit application looked at on the merits by having the veto power of the downstream landowner refusing to consent. If you look under 103D521, it states that a person may not be deprived or divested under this chapter of a previously established beneficial use of right or right without due process of law. And I think the consent issue is essentially a statement that, if construed literally, as Mr. Pieper expresses, that the watershed district is essentially delegating authority to make or enforce its permitting rules to downstream landowners. So it's essentially a legislative function or a quasi-judicial function for the board to review the permit application and to make specific findings. And to state that one downstream landowner not providing consent deprives the watershed district of the ability to hear a matter on the merits, I think, is an unlawful delegation of authority. And separate from that, I believe that the burden is on Mr. Zutz and the appellants to show that there's not adequate findings. But I think the findings of the watershed district are more than satisfactory. There's two engineers' opinions in regard to the adequacy of the outlet, the hydraulic capacity of the limited nature, you know, of the flows that are being provided. And I think the court should also take into consideration that 100 acres of this was already part of the benefited legal drainage system for JD251. It was only an additional 48 acres that was added as part of the watershed proceedings. So Mr. Erickson had the right legally to drain those 100 acres of surface water into the JD251 system. And appellate case law does not really make any distinction between surface water drainage or subsurface tile drainage. The legal right to drain remains the same. And we pointed that out in case law in regard to our brief, Evers versus Willoughby, also Prawl versus Bosch, Pell versus Nelson, which all reflect applying the same rules in regard to tile drainage applications. I think it's also important to note that the proposed tile is a gravity feed outlet. And so when the water's coming out, if the ditch itself is full, it's going to back up as part of the gravity tile outlet. So it's not going to be adding all that additional water. And then with the safeguard of having, you know, the operable gate installed, I don't know how the argument comes about that there's harm to downstream landowners. If the watershed district, as it did, states if downstream conditions are flooding, then that gate is closed. And there's no water that's being discharged, so there's nothing that's being contributed by Mr. Erickson that could possibly harm any downstream landowners. So I think just based on the record itself that, I mean, everything that's set forth in there and all the findings are supported by the record. I don't think there's any argument in regard to that. And I would again point out that in regard to the EOR engineering report, there is no evidence presented that there is insufficient capacity. There is no evidence presented that there's going to be harm to the downstream landowners. The only thing they did was allege certain deficiencies in the method that the engineers' conclusions were arrived at, but they do not contest the engineers' conclusions. And with that, I'll end.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Pieper, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points in response to Mr. Sparvey, and I'll start with that last one. In our briefing, we've outlined at least 11 different ways in which EOR criticized in just only its preliminary report, both the findings and conclusions of Dowager and Norby and the data that was provided by the Watershed District and relied on by the Watershed District itself. Those are all outlined in our brief. The Norby letter was prepared and submitted as part of a separate petition, and that was submitted before the Watershed District actually denied. So the Watershed District had the Norby letter and still denied the permit application for failure to identify an adequate outlet. The Dowager report is just a one-page report that doesn't identify the basis or the for its conclusions or any of the work that was undertaken to determine those conclusions. Those are part of the criticisms that EOR levied. And the issue with the EOR preliminary report, set aside the timing and whether they had enough time or data to prepare a complete report, that represented in and of itself contradictory evidence that the Watershed District had to consider and had to deal with. And the record shows that the Watershed didn't. It paid, it received it, and it noted it in an aesthetic nature. And we've identified the reasons why that's not sufficient in our briefing as a legal matter.
But it, under the substantial evidence review, if are we really required to reweigh those competing views of the evidence if the Watershed District, as you said, received it and noted it and just decided to go a different way in its findings?
This, Your Honor, I would point you to our brief at pages 19 to 21, as well as our references to the City of Cohasset decision, appellate decision from 2023, and the Citizens Advocating Responsible Development case that I mentioned earlier. Just because a report or evidence is distributed, this is the Citizens Advocating Responsible Development, doesn't mean that it was actually considered. And the consideration has to be more than aesthetic in nature. That's the Citizens Advocating Responsible Development. There's no indication here that the Watershed District paid any mind whatsoever to the EOR preliminary report. That's the point, for Your Honor. You don't have to weigh Dowager and Norby versus EOR. The point is that the Watershed District didn't. That's the point. And that's the failure of substantial evidence on that particular piece or one of them. And then on the as to substantial evidence with respect to the increased ag production notation, Mr. Sparvey's comments are frankly fairly remarkable. I mean, he's conceding that there is no other evidence here. There isn't even a scintilla of evidence to back that up. And the point of it is that there must be something. Does increased ag production mean increase by a single plant, a single corn stalk? Does it mean increased production by a 50% yield? We don't know. And that's highly problematic here. And that goes to both the reasonable necessity, but also weighing the utility of benefit versus the gravity of the harm. Because if the benefit is only, oh, we'll do this project and we're only going to increase our yield by a single plant,
But aren't you kind of elevating this factor? I mean, at the end of those four factors in Kroll, the languages in determining reasonableness, the court should consider the extent of the harm caused, its foreseeability, and the landowner's motive for the action taken. No one factor or circumstance is controlling, and what is a reasonable use is a fact question to be resolved depending on the facts of each case. So even if we agree with you, I mean, and everything you said is true, and that it's just limited to the permit, as Mr. Sparby seemed to concede. Why should that result in a reversal and remand to the district?
And that's a fair question, Your Honor. But that's why I raised the point that that the failure of provide any evidence in support of that statement goes to more than just one factor here. It goes to a question of reasonable necessity, yes, but it also goes to the question of whether the benefit outweighed the potential harm, the third factor. So two out of the four factors, there's a failure of evidence here, and there's a failure of the watershed district to identify substantial evidence to support its findings on both of those factors. And so that's why that's critical there. If I may just address one point, otherwise I see that I'm
Go
out of
right
time.
ahead. Go right ahead.
Mr. Sparby, in the discussion of the rule, it's frankly further remarkable to me that somebody who's speaking on behalf of a government agency would effectively read out a clear definition, read out its own language in its rules, or ask the court to disregard it. We are not asking this court to liberally construe the watershed district's rules. The watershed district's rule is clear. It requires written consent of landowners with a permit application. It is also clear that that didn't occur here. That's the watershed district's rule. It's not my rule. It's not your rule. The watershed district chose to insert that rule. And it just refused to apply it, and it refused to even acknowledge it. And that's, I thank you, Your Honor, for your time and attention.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sparby. Thank you, Mr. Pieper. We will issue our decision in 90 days.